You're listening to The Last Exit Show with Caleb Horton and James Murphy.
Let's go ahead and try and get the ball rolling again. Get some of that old casual energy back with an unscripted improvisational sketch, all right?
Sounds good. I'll try and improvise at my very highest.
Yeah, and I'm going to just throw you a very simple idea and we're going to kind of roll with it.
Sounds good.
So here's the idea. I'm going to play Irene, a chocoholic. And you're man, okay? And man. You're just kind of talking to her at some sort of business casual work function, all right?
All right. Okay. So,
Go ahead and start improvising at me.
Hey, Irene. I haven't met you yet. What are you about?
I consider myself a chocoholic. I'm into all of it. I'm into all of it, and I'm totally indiscriminating when I have to be. Hershey bars, Ghirardelli chocolate, See's chocolate. I'm an ardent proponent of fascism, Hershey bars, you name it. I love it all.
Hold on, did you just say you're an ardent proponent of fascism?
Yeah, I love chocolate. Me and chocolate were utterly inseparable. I believe in neither the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. Whatever happened to chocolate soda, don't you wonder? You read about it all the time, especially books about the 50s, but you can't find it anywhere. I wonder if BevMo carries chocolate soda.
Yeah, they do.
Look, the pursuit of happiness is a myth. Even with all this chocolate, I'm not happy. I'm not even looking for that anymore. A people. Any group of people you want to name, let's say the board of directors at Hershey's, they're only as strong as the mother state, you understand me? If the state is not strong, its product isn't strong either. Hershey bar is a pathetic thing. The largest chocolate manufacturer in North America, and it's not even real chocolate, it's a reflection of our slide away from absolute power. Only a weak country allows such a weak product to achieve such prominence.
Do you have any friends? I've got the hunch that you're lonely.
We become strongest when we have no friends upon whom to lean or to look for moral guidance.
You're really going off of that chocolate there, Irene. Better face yourself.
It is better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. And then I guess she would explain fascism some more and they would get married and Irene would bear you 3 beautiful children and they live happily ever after.
Do you think that her fascist politics might clash slightly against my soft
anarchy? Yeah, she loves chocolate. She loves chocolate. Hershey bars, man, that's not very good chocolate, but she'll eat it anyway. She doesn't care, you know?
American chocolate tastes terrible. I can tell you that as someone who's visited your country, it tastes like water.
I love that you visited our country, but you visited Florida, which is obviously the worst part of our country.
At New York City, I went to New York, New York, just like Frank Sinatra sang in that one song, Chicago.
Wow, what was New York like?
I went there with a friend of mine for my 18th birthday. My mum saved up for about 7 years to send us both out there. And my overriding memory is I was in New York, and I felt like I had to do something. There had to be something to be achieved, and so we got to this hotel, a really grotty Sid and Nancy looking style hotel, and I thought, I'm in New York City, I'm 18 years old, there's got to be some adventure out there. So I hit the streets in my leather jacket that I'd bought in Disneyland a few years before, and I was walking around in the streets, and a homeless guy came out and he said, "You're out late, baby," and it scared me, so I went back to the hotel for 2 days.
So you went all the way to New York City and you just stayed in a hotel?
Went to the cinema too. Went to go and see The Brave one starring Jodie Foster.
That's a terrible way to spend a vacation in New York, but I don't know how I would react because to me New York is a pretend place.
Yeah, it only exists in the films of Woody Allen and Francis Ford Coppola.
And I've known a couple of musicians who claim to have played there, but when they talk about it, it's kind of unconvincing. They're like, "We went to the venue, all right."
There's a hotel, you know, there's JFK Hotel, and people land there, and they have to go and visit a room with a very threatening man in braces and attire, and he says it would be better for everyone if you told people you're in New York. And what's that over there? You'd say to the man in the braces and the shirt, and he'd say, "Don't you worry about what's going on over there. Now, just you get back on the plane for a couple of hours."
Don't look out that window. Don't look out there.
So it's been a little while since we recorded. I think this is our longest break in over a year of doing this show. And I've certainly missed it. I haven't missed the internet at all because it's a horrible time suck that I'm hopelessly addicted to. I've achieved so much without the internet in my life. But I've missed doing this show, and I've missed having that one guitar tuning video from about 2006 that has 14 million views, because the guitar had gotten so insanely out of tune, it started to sound like some woodsman's outsider art, and I haven't got the ear to either tune it myself or use the, you know that tune that you blow into and the noise comes out?
No.
Well, it's...
No, I have no idea.
Anyway, the guitar sounded like someone was strangling an ostrich, so I missed that and I missed doing this show. How have you been without this show to return to?
I've been doing pretty well. Let me go back to guitar stuff for a second. Guitar technical demonstrations for conferences and stuff of new equipment for vendors. Those are some of the best videos you'll ever find on YouTube.
Why?
Me and my cousin used to like get really drunk and watch videos of people showing off new guitar equipment for jazz fusion fetishists and like the NAMM conference in Anaheim. And those videos are all just perfect because... Nobody who makes those videos has any self-awareness of what they're doing. It all looks like found footage now.
Guitar people are strange people. Because if you're a normal person, you just want to know the chords to your favorite songs and be able to pick out some kind of strange approximation, some rhythmless approximation of the sound of your favorite songs. And I think
Here's one of the videos we used to look for when you were looking for technical demonstrations of guitar equipment. It was the Synth Axe.
Okay.
It was just a very, very L.A. dude who kind of didn't know that it wasn't 1986 anymore. And this was the sort of fake guitar that you could only imagine anyone ever using for some sort of, like, folk speed metal band or maybe somebody who scores anime.
Right.
And it was just, it's this other world that I know nothing about, and so it fascinates me.
Yeah, it just seems like life is going to be a series of finding out about subcultures that you've got no idea about. But there's hundreds of thousands of people that are so intimately entwined with that in their lives. It's like picking up rocks and seeing these scurrying ants that are really into, let's take something completely at random, Japanese animation from the 1930s.
What did I do while you were gone? I honestly went so deep into solipsism that it became incredibly unhealthy after a while. I'm not going to lie. One of the very first things I did was I started joking that I would completely reboot The Last Exit Show without you as just this sort of crypto-conservative rock and roll talk show from L.A., and I would just do the most insanely idiotic jock stuff. And I would just completely dilute the brand and sell out as hard as you possibly can in 2014. Be one of the last people to do conventional bullshit radio.
So are you saying that I am that thin blue line between you being a sane, productive member of society with the place to vent into and you being strange messiah-like figure who loses his mind and gains some strange followers out in the desert?
Absolutely. You're the only thing separating me from semi-coherency and total madness.
Just gaining a Manson family of sorts around you.
But no, this running joke started to get really out of hand that I fire you and replace you with like a revolving door of 23-year-old female sidekicks. So let me just go ahead and do a couple examples of the sort of show I was joking about running during our off time. We're back. Now, hidey high and a hoity ho to everybody stuck out there in traffic. It's The Last Exit Show. I'm Caleb Horton. It's my new sidekick. Let's call her Jennifer. It's my new sidekick, Jennifer. I've crossed a lot of boundaries with Jennifer, haven't I? Yeah, but enough about me. Over the next few weeks, I'm sending Jennifer to some of the most dangerous bars in Los Angeles County, and she's going to report on that, and it's going to be really fun. You excited, Jennifer, about those dive bars? And then she would say yes, because I would be paying her an exorbitant salary.
Yeah, I think it'd be a lot of money in that, so you'd be definitely able to pay Jennifer quite a bit. I feel like that she'd pick up some kind of clashing together of two different concepts as a nickname, so she could be like the rock and roll Buddhist, something like that.
I would probably be hell-bent on calling her Jennifer, and I would constantly talk about all the boundaries I crossed with her without specifying what those boundaries were.
My name is Dawn. What's that, Jennifer?
All my woman co-hosts I would eventually call Jennifer.
Yeah. And as you're leaving, your producer says to the lady, she's like, he doesn't seem to get it. And the producer's like, it's better that he doesn't know we get new people in to sit next to him. Just pretend you're the same one from last week.
I would have no self-awareness at all. It would be this horrible nightmare where I descend into a character and never rebound out of it, ever.
Like what happened to Howard Stern.
Right, exactly. I would start driving a white sports car around Burbank and just going, I love this city. Forget about it.
Yeah.
But I would try to hold on to certain elements of The Last Exit Show, but I don't have the self-awareness to figure out what the important elements were anymore. So I would hold on to like a relic of the outlaw country undertones that we've had going on through the show. Mm-hmm. You know, I would shuffle paper. Let's see. Let's do the shuffling paper. Willie Nelson with us for the full hour. Willie Nelson got a new album coming out on Yip Rock Records. How about that? Willie Nelson, the redheaded stranger himself. You're gonna really love what we got coming up for you guys.
And Willie just sitting there having to give the most promotional interview going with just no depth whatsoever.
The redheaded stranger himself, Willie Nelson. Now, Willie, I understand you got a new album coming out called Band of Brothers. Now, you've been hitching down that rough highway. You've been doing some hard traveling for a lot longer than I've been alive. But surely, Willie Nelson, the redheaded stranger, you know that there's a popular TV show called Band of Brothers, don't you? Or maybe the album was an homage to that. Care to elaborate, Willie?
It's an exciting time. It's a very exciting.
I understand you wrote two of these songs with Billy Joe Shaver. They're actually Billy Joe Shaver covers, and that's really impressive to me because me and Billy Joe, we go way back.
I've known Billy about 10 years. I first met him.
Saw him at the Redwood Bar and Grill, and man, I hollered at that whole audience. If Bob Dylan doesn't have dirt on you, Billy Joe Shaver, and oh, he got a big kick out of that. The LA Times loved it. I got a mention in the LA Times over that. That was fantastic, Willie Nelson. Now, well, Billy, you're going to play a couple songs for us in a little bit, aren't you, Willie?
Yeah, I'd be happy to play for you.
Now, okay, I'm sure everybody asks you this, Willie Nelson, all right? But you've been rolling a little bit of that Mary Jane. You've been having some weed before you come on in the studio, because I hate weed. But I love you, Willie Nelson.
Thank you. That's kind of easy to say.
So what song are you going to play here? You might do Hard to Be an Outlaw for me. How about you do that one?
Sure. I can do that for you. Yeah, sure.
Oh, thanks, Willie Nelson. We love you here, the redheaded stranger himself. I listened to that album so much in high school. Riding and Hiding His Pain. You know that? How about you play that one, Willie Nelson?
Well, I'd like to play something for the new record, really.
I would send Jennifer to do very dangerous things. I would, like, tell her. For example, I would tell her that I was sending her to a dangerous dive bar, and she would think it's some sort of bohemian adventure.
Yeah.
But I would just send her to a den of drug dealers at a warehouse, and I would go, oh, how did you like that, Jennifer? I bet that was really exciting. You learned how the other side lives, didn't you?
The first three Jennifers have died. Really?
I'm on Jennifer 7. I'm like Johnny Carson.
The FCC is constantly investigating your peccadilloes.
I'm constantly running from the IRS. Some of the episodes are recorded in the Philippines, and Jennifer can't even be there.
A really bad microphone. Your voice sounds like it's coming from a 1930s radio, like Orson Welles.
What else do you think would happen to me if I went full-blown crypto conservative talk show, if you left permanently?
I like the idea of you just stealing parts of the show without having any of its soul. So like you'd slip into Facebook for the week or something stupid at the end, you know, just like your mother's niggling you about not having told any of your cousins lately. Well, that's something that happened on Facebook, and moving on down to the next part, just trying to fill as much dead air as possible before catch the date in the current Democrat.
Twitter for the week. Gawker's been getting up to some exciting investigations over there. I heard that women get paid 78% as much as men. That can't be true, Jennifer. You get paid even more than I do.
And they will laugh because that's obviously not true. You right. Be drawing from the Huffington Post. And
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we got to talk about this. The top 8 architectural achievements in Los Angeles. I've been to none of these, but I understand Jennifer's been to all of them. Hey, how about you enlighten us a little bit about that? Oh, it's on the west side. Not gonna go there. Never mind. Let's talk about something else.
No, I'd listen to
Twitter for the week. Twitter for the week. I'll just run down midnight. You know those what are those bullshit things they do called those hashtag games?
ruin a movie title with a bud's name. That was pretty
no
good.
Country for old dudes, ladies and gentlemen. That's funny shit. The FCC is going to find me. I apologize. I am not Howard Stern, ladies and gentlemen.
Howard Stern's a bad man. That was a pretty good at midnight hashtag. Maybe I should get paid to sit in that writer's room with Tris Hardwick as his identity crisis goes on and he brings up his long-ago alcoholism once more.
You know, I was going to write an article about this, but I eventually lost passion for it. I was going to talk about how Chris Hardwick kind of is a perfect encapsulation of everything that's wrong with the American comedy scene in 2014.
Uh-huh.
Not even that he's untalented. I'm sure he's a talented guy, but philosophically, I disagree with it, what it is he does.
Yeah.
And I was going to write about that, but I got so distracted by Hobo Graffiti that I lost the pitch completely, and I was going to tie it into Hobo Graffiti. And I realized this is only amusing me, so I shelved it.
There's nothing better than when you start out at something and you procrastinate a bit, and the thing that you're more interested in starts pushing it way into what you're writing. It's like if I would do an essay at school, and somehow, you know, Freddy versus Jason would make its way into it. The works of Milton are a lot like Freddy versus Jason. There's conflict, and in some ways they encapsulate that fight between the devil and Satan.
Yeah, it's when the thing that you're actually interested in starts to overwhelm your bullshit pitch, it's when you know you're in trouble as a writer. Because you're just going to lose people, so if you're going to bleed audience.
I did a piece for Ruthless Reviews. It's going to be the first in the series where I do all of Netflix's specials. I was doing it on Twitter anyway, so I thought I might as well expand it in a place where people would be happy to see it. And my partner read it, and she said, yeah, it reads like you know, all of your inverted snobbery pokes right through it.
It did, yeah. I'm very excited that you're starting the writing journey. I just hope you don't turn into me. Do you want to talk any more about the thing you wrote? Did you learn anything about the online process? Were there any pathologies that started to come into play for no reason?
The main thing I learned was if you want to get anything done, stay away from the internet for 2 weeks. That's my first piece of advice for everything. Just stay away from the internet for 2 weeks. Stay away from the internet for 2 weeks, and if you go on your first date, don't mention the Holocaust. That's two things I learned.
Those are pretty important things to know. Those are pretty important things for, you know, a 12-year-old to know, actually. You should have figured that out easier.
Perhaps. Perhaps I'm a slow man.
But what do I actually know about the writing game that's helpful to people? Oh, here's one. A lot of people write in the online form, or they write in WordPress or whatever. And I turn off my router and I write in Microsoft Word. I collect all the notes I could possibly need and I write in Microsoft Word.
I don't want to step further than that. I'm right on the paper because even Microsoft Word has too much to distract you. So just a room with a pen and paper and then typing it up, that can be your second draft.
I love the idea of that, but not for any Neo-Luddite reasons. But I can't do that because I write slower than I think and I type as fast as I think.
Oh, really?
So I'm able to get a thought down immediately if I have a cue word in front of me, but if I'm writing by hand and it doesn't pan out.
Just throwing it across the room like so many writerly cliches. Do you find yourself falling into any of these old writerly cliches? I remember there was an old article we may have discussed on here before. Things you know you're doing if you're a writer. Is there any of that stuff that you do?
No, I don't do any of that. I don't even have writer's block. Sometimes I'll lose a pitch, and that's fine, but that's not writer's block. That's just me being disinterested in the kind of writing that I have been allowed to do by the free market.
It's all capitalism, and it's very hot.
Yeah, because trust me, if it was up to me, and I had control of editorial content, I would be mostly writing about Hobo Graffiti.
So, Mr. Horton, I've got $100,000 American, and you have as many words as you need to take this story, to write your story, and I'll give you a year to write it in. What's your pitch for me? I mean, it's sitting here, you can have it no matter what your pitch is. I'd just like to hear it first. I'll start getting excited.
Trains and hobos on trains. 100,000 words, no problem. I have tea in 3 days.
He'll be sitting in every Barnes and Noble from here to Wichita.
I would talk just about the open road in the American Southwest and American myth and highwayside motels. Very cliche.
Just digressing wildly about a motel that you read about once when you're supposed to be right about Woody Nelson.
I think that's the most entertaining kind of writing, though, is writing that doesn't have a very good pitch. I think it's fun to make fun of the American myth, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite tropes, is the idea of someone who gets lost in the act of writing something, and it just veers off in a direction it should never have done, and starts taking in points and tenuous political viewpoints that just shouldn't have snuck in there.
Matt, you know the other thing that people tell you to do that I think I can't do, that I'm ashamed of when I try, is they say to write like you talk.
Oh, right.
Write as if you're having a conversation, and I can't do it.
No, well, I'm not a very good talker, as people of our podcast may have noticed. So it's like, what would the point be in that? How many times do you want me to double back in the thing that I'm writing?
Exactly. If I was given a pitch that even I was interested in working with, let's say it is the new Willie Nelson album, Band of Brothers, which of course I'm going to listen to.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm talking about that. I would get distracted after 50, maybe 60 words, and I would start writing, you know, I could really use some coffee right now because I'm really having difficulty focusing and the screen is disorienting me and I don't really like the town I live in or the circumstances in which I live in it.
Yeah,
and it would all turn into hating my life, and there would be no Willie Nelson references, except that that line in Red-Headed Stranger, he's writing and hiding his pain, is an awesome line. That would be all I would have to say about Willie Nelson.
It'd be great if you worked for a traditional newspaper and were sent out to interview people, let's say Mitch Hurwitz, creator of Arrested Development, a program that you liked, and then you're sent out there and you start out with a fairly, you know, appropriate question. So Mitch, did you feel pleased when Netflix brought up that fourth season of Arrested Development, and he'd give his very charming, very literate American comedy answer, and then in the next one you'd be like to him, can you see how much pain I'm in? You see how it hurts? And he'd probably react in a way that he would be thinking is funny and charming. He'd think this is a bit, you know, he can yes and this, that's fine. And then your next one, you'd be like, look at me. See me, Mitch Hurwitz. See me as I am now.
Stare at me, Mitch. Look me dead in the eye.
I am alone.
Let's one more thing I did occur to me. If I was doing that crypto conservative radio show, I would still have the same musical influences. I would just treat everybody like dirt.
Yeah.
So here, hold on. Let me do one more thing. Legendary Keith Richards dead at 89. Very very big deal. There's a lot of people who remember Keith Richards who really affected their childhood. Here to comment on the passing of Keith Richards, Bobby Womack. Bobby, my man, and be honest, when was the last time you walked across 110th Street?
It's been a few years now, but, you know, that song was a...
Do you mind playing that for us, Bobby?
I don't have a band with me, Caleb.
Nah, I got an old guitar you can pick on. You still pick on that guitar, don't you, Bobby Womack?
Sure, I'll play it for you. I love you, sure.
Everybody would just be sucking up to me. I would get huge ratings, too. That's always part of the... All of my fantasies involve being the worst person alive, but my ratings are great.
You walk into boardrooms openly contemptuous of the network president, and you walk out and they go, well, we can't argue his numbers. You wear a sweatsuit to the meeting. You're too busy to stay there for too long.
A tracksuit, but I don't jog anywhere. Where the hell have I ever jogged to?
Caleb, Zooey this channel is thinking of suing. Yeah.
I walk around in a tracksuit, but I'm just drinking. I'm not doing any jogging at all.
Your personal assistant's main job is getting a dustpan and brush to pick up the broken whiskey bottle from out your office.
That becomes a recurring bit in the green room. I just smash whiskey bottles around like David Lee Roth. That would be what I would become. I would become the outlaw country version of David Lee Roth.
An angry alcoholic that your guests duck and a clearly terrified of you, but your numbers are too good. You can't argue. You just have to go on the show and pretend to like it.
You know, the very first thing I would do, because the show is so heavily about regionalism and how that's changing, I would disown where I'm from completely. I was born in Pasadena, as far as those assholes are concerned.
Scarlett Johansson, shut up.
Jennifer, get her out of here.
Don't talk about my president like that.
What would the dark moments be? I guess the dark moments would be I would be defending a Republican president. Yeah. And the guest would say, no, I think gun control's really good. And then I would do the, you know, when radio DJs get serious, get out.
No, now.
No, yeah. And then dead air. You let the dead air hang a little bit too long. No, I'm serious. No, you don't get it. This is a big deal to me. I need you to leave. Jennifer!
And your current Jennifer is a bald, burly man. Just throwing Scarlett Johansson bodily out. But it's a dream of a war that's going on.
I have like three or four bodyguards at all times.
The name tags will just say Jennifer.
I never have any need for the bodyguards. I just want to be known as someone who has bodyguards. I'm inaccessible deliberately. What would happen? I would cultivate some unlikely friendships if I did this. Oh, here's one. I would be great friends with Bob Dylan for asshole reasons. I was over at Bobby D's house. We got some Jose Cuervo. Watch some boxing.
Robert, I called him.
What would happen if you actually got this kind of autonomy, if you took the reins of the Last Exit Show and wrote it into LA super prominence?
I don't know. I mean, in reality, I'd probably really phone it in. I wouldn't, like, give any thought to it whatsoever, and I'd hire a team of assistants, probably stripped it out for me.
And you would, yeah.
I'd be drunk most of the time, I'd imagine, and using it as excuse to propel my friends and family to a higher level of notoriety and money.
An excuse to drive. You start drinking more deliberately as a way to drive people away and become inaccessible like I was.
Yeah.
Here's what you would do, though. Whereas I would never write anything ever, and I would just say, I'm a superstar, baby. You would become Garrison Keillor or some shit. And you would have this heavily NPR, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the decline of the American small town and what's left.
Tonight on the Last Exit Show, we'll have a song from a promising acoustic guitar player, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what the steel mills are up to today. But first, we're going to talk about how the online distribution model is really changing up for filmmakers. Now, tell me, Mr. Woody Harrelson, what do you think about this?
Well, I think that 9/11 didn't happen.
That's an interesting point of view. I think there's a lot of people that disagree with you, Woody Harrelson. But frankly, this is the kind of show where we just let things go back and forth.
My buddy Caleb's working that into season 3 of True Detective.
Yes. Yes.
How 9/11 didn't happen. That's what season 3 is about. He's great, Caleb.
I like that idea that season 3 of True Detective is entirely just Woody Harrelson standing in front of a whiteboard with a pen, and there's some crudely drawn towers, and he's got a plastic plane that he's going towards it. But he never gets to the 9/11 truth a bit behind him. He rambles and he smokes a little bit of weed.
I live in Hawaii next to Chris Christopherson.
Woody, I was hearing something about a prom date to a young lady there, and you threw out a car. Did that happen, or is that just a lie?
Yeah, it happened. We're working that into the next season of True Detective. Caleb loved that part.
I tell you, Caleb, somebody good died, and I don't know how to put it in a way that American listeners might understand, but for me, it was the equivalent of Billy Murray dying. Bill Murray was an actor in Ghostbusters, and it was Rick Mayall who
started. Let me go ahead and cut you off for just a second to explain where I'm coming from, and I say this without a bit of pretense. The only people who I knew who told me about this guy's death were all known and notorious Anglophiles, so I ignored them out of habit, and I assumed that this was somebody really pretentious. So that's kind of a construct that you need to break down a little bit for me going into that.
Well, immediately, he was the opposite of a pretentious performer. He was a very childish performer. It's one of the reasons why his comedy hit me at such a young age. It was very much about farts and burps and willies and things like that. He was amused by that till the day he died. And he was roundly anti-liberal. If you ever saw, there was a literal BBC interview with him, and they're like, well, why wasn't there a fourth series of your TV show called Bottom, Rich Mail? And Rick Mail being Rick Mail, who could get away with anything, was like, well, I think some dyke bitch at the BBC didn't like it. It's kind of amazing that he was able to say something like that.
You know what I would do in the press kit for that guy, if you were still alive? You know how I would rationalize all that? I would say he's a comedian for the working class.
The working class love him. But yeah, a very, very funny man. He just he played those sort of huge kind of characters, very broad humour. But because everyone saw him when they were little, everyone had great affection for him, as did I. You know, it's a new era for British comedy, and without Rick Mail on this planet now, you know, bigger than this planet that he's walking on, I think it's a sadder time, really. You know, and Rick Mail really did exemplify the kind of comedy that I think.
Oh shit! We gotta cut to a commercial. Hi, I'm Jerry. I grew up on a farm. I always loved hard work, and I loved unwinding with a big bowl of homemade ice cream. I'd sit on my grandma's lap on our farm outside Nashville. We'd make peach ice cream in a big tin pail. I'd stir and stir, as you do, with an enormous silver spoon my grandma gave me. Grandma would tell me stories about the Depression, about how to enjoy things you made yourself, and I'd stir the spoon, and darn if that ice cream didn't taste 10 times better than if I'd bought it in a store. That's why the logo for Jerry's Ice Cream is a silver spoon, to remind me where I came from, of sitting on my grandma's lap in Tennessee. I learned on that farm that cows are very important, that they can give and give for you every day, that milk and ice cream are more important than any cut of meat could ever be. Why kill a cow when you can get milk from it every day and use it to make peach ice cream like Grandma did? Pigs are a different story. And the murderers from Hell Biker Gang are motherfucking pigs. We killed pigs on my farm, and this town needs to rally together and treat these meth-slinging pieces of shit like the pigs they are. Kill the murderers from hell. Kill them like pigs, like the filth they is. We can't let one more person die because of Mad Dog's insane bullshit. Take him down. Help me take him down. The back of Jerry's ice cream has enough ammunition to start and finish World War III. You don't think we can get him? We'll get him if you help me kill the murderers from hell. That's Jerry's ice cream on 11th and Magnolia. Come on down to Jerry's ice cream. Have yourself a scoop.
I'm just sad that he's done, really. I didn't expect him. He seemed to have this kind of invulnerability, this immortality, this invincibility. So it's just a reminder that death stalks us all, Caleb, you know?
Well, I wanted to talk about broadness. I think all the best comedians are broad.
What does that mean?
You said that he was a very broad comedian, right?
How do you mean that all comedians are broad?
No, all my favorite, all the best ones. The ones that I like the most.
Right.
Because they're the least pretentious. And I think a guy like Bill Murray or Patrice O'Neill, or I guess I should be coming up with better names than that, Richard Pryor, none of those people were ever tried to call themselves intellectuals seriously, you know what I mean?
Well, you get like that, you get somebody like Bill Maher, whose main thing is going Republicans and then snorting derisively.
I saw him on Conan. I went to a Conan taping with Bill Maher, and he was roundly booed. They cut that out. There were tons of boos, and with the scattered fake applause.
It's the easiest job in the world, is Bill Maher's.
Just being condescending. See, the thing is, it's not about politics.
No,
because he could be condescending about anything you threw at him. He could have he could be the new host of Man vs. Food, and he would say, this has too much grease in it. Disgusting.
Yeah, they should put Bill Maher in situations that he has to react condescendingly to, because he had that film, I think it was called Religious, and it was just him being shitty for an hour and a half about religions.
Yeah.
Just put him
Didn't in the... He trotted out that a lot of really bad Snopes disproven bullshit where he says, Christians think that Jesus was born on December 25th. Guess what, Billy? No one thinks that.
Literally no one over the age of 5 thinks that.
We know that there's pagan roots in what we consider Christmas, you idiot.
It's just a hateful group of straw men that he's attacking all the time.
Mm-hmm. But for a movie that I hated, he was kind of funny in A Million Ways to Die in the West, because he's at a square dance and he just does his idiot shitty act. Like, he's still very much from Boston in this movie. Let's get back to this British guy. Are you done talking about this dead British guy?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, hey, I have a question. This is a serious question that I probably should have done off the air, but why not? I'm an ignorant person, so let's flesh it out in public.
Sure.
Tell me the difference between British and English.
Britain is the larger kind of fake construct that came from an empire that included Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And England's a slightly smaller part that's got nothing to do with Scotland, Wales, or Northern Ireland.
Is it strictly geographical, or is British used in an imperialistic way?
I think it's strictly geographic, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I'm not too much of a problem by saying. So I called somebody British and I said, should I call them English? I have no idea what I'm doing.
Nice. Fine. There's so much I don't know about America. A lot of this show has been me just dropping ignorant and frankly racist preconceptions about your country.
How much of it have you been wrong about? I don't America. Know. I guess the mistake isn't thinking that culture is everywhere, or that whatever you consider to be America is taking place all the time.
I think, yeah, the mistake lies in a homogenized and generalized idea of anything. I think one thing that people should always learn as they get older or wiser is that there's no way that generalizations ever work for anything at all. And the second you start thinking about objects, people, places in that manner, and also realizing that everything is the same, every people are identical, then I think life makes a lot more sense.
I agree. I was. It occurred to me recently that our lives are actually very, very similar. There's not a whole lot of British and Englishness versus Americanness permeating the divide of the show, I don't think.
No, I think that's also got something to do with the fact that I'm very into American culture. I find it very interesting. And, like, you're a bright individual, you're a clever guy, and, you know, you kind of cherry-pick the best parts of what England might have to offer, so you know what the English office is. You've rightly decided that Monty Python is full of shit, so there's all that.
I gave that such a firm attempt to understand. I tried to parse that so hard when I was 14.
The old cottage try.
But I think we've played up some conflict a little bit because it's funny to pretend we have it, but we don't.
Nah.
And plus, I mean, ultimately, I've been trying to reconcile the fact that I'm kind of an urban individual. I like cities.
No, you don't.
No, I do, actually, because a city isn't a place where I can have hope that there's someone like me there in the depths. That there are other people who are rejected by whatever ultra-conservative small town they're from, and they can, I can find camaraderie with people. I had friends in L.A. I actually had real-life friends that I would go do stuff with. Can you believe that?
There's parts of this city I absolutely loathe. I hate it so much, and there's so many people here. It's just, like, give me a break for a little while.
You know what? Let me clarify what... I am a country fella, but there's kind of different layers of that. Small towns I hate and the country I love.
That sounds like a song lyric.
Usually, if the small town, the small towns that I've been in are generally full of very angry people and they're overrun by meth and they don't want to leave their houses ever. And I'm a big believer in if there was a community identity in the town I lived in, if I ever had seen traces of one, then I would be more keen to embrace the whole lifestyle, but I'm not.
If you could only visit the imaginary America in my head from when I was about 15, you'd be having a whale of a time, all the line dances.
I have no idea what line dancing is. I have no clue. None.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have a great time. You know, you'd have your arm in arm with a plump country girl with shining blonde hair and a pretty attractive smile, and you'd be dancing around to a fiddle going. You'd have a great time in James's imaginary America of 2004.
All right, talk about you moved and all that good stuff. So I just moved about, what was it, about 8 months ago now, which we documented on the show. So let's treat this as magnanimously a word. Let's give you your take on the moving experience.
Ah, it's fine, man. Like, I've heard again and again, moving is the most stressful thing you'll ever do.
It's wrong.
It's the mantra you get. It's just putting things from one place to another. And you have to make a bunch of annoying phone calls over and over and over.
Uh-huh.
But mostly what it is having your own space and feeling fine and starting to be concerned with things that were previously the domain of your parent. Dull stuff. Stuff like damp. Stuff like the garbage disposal timetable. Stuff like, where do I put this food now that there's nothing left of it? How do I get rid of these flies? Oh no, I've got a garden. I have to go and dig weeds. I hate gardening so much. I've got a vengeful fucking loathing of gardening. I had to go and pull up some weeds just the other day. And can you imagine me, based on what you know about me, having any type of a good time trying to get weeds up by their roots? I've got a trowel in my hand and a big audio dynamite hat to block the sun away.
That's hysterical, man. That's such a horrible juxtaposition for me to have to imagine.
The sweat shining off my face and a miserable expression on my countenance.
I'm not going to lie, I don't like gardening either, but I do like certain kinds of it. There are certain divides that I resent pulling weeds because I still, to this day, I can't tell them apart from grass.
Nah.
But... and I don't think that they look particularly worse, so I don't. It seems like a pointless game to be playing.
Just leave it where it is. It seems fine. I'll just bring out a deck chair. I'll drink a beer and I'll read this Boris Karloff biography. But no, where I've moved to now, I'm a little bit further down the road in London. I'm further out than when I was living, but it's a shorter commute to work, which is great. But I have to get the train, and it's a major international train station I'm living near. And as you know, if you're anywhere near a train station, the streets are paved with lowlives trying to hassle you for money. And there's also, along the way, a rehab centre. So I have to walk past the fallibility of human nature as alcoholics lie to me about needing to call imaginary aunts. And one of them was really wonderfully blatant about it. As I was coming back from the train station, I come back to my house about 10:30 at night. And he's like, I think he was about 33-ish, very skinny, denim jacket, tracksuit bottoms, trainers. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I need about 30p. I said, well, here you go, mate. It's a pound, whatever. And I'm walking along, and he immediately goes into an off-license, a liquor store in front of me. It's like, well, you got your money. What more did you need out of me?
Yeah, I've had that experience a couple of times. I don't know how to deal with it.
He literally just walked out of the rehab. It was a revolving door of failure.
I have seen it. There's a rehab down the street from me with kind of the same eight people in it. And there's a liquor store across the street from the rehab. And I'll see you guys walk out of the rehab and go immediately to the corner store and get a couple of 40s.
So
and just pound it. They'll pound it by the outdoor bathroom. And I'll just, it's just, I don't. It's hard for me to take issue with it because if I was living on my own in this town and I'd burned all my bridges with friends, I'd probably be doing the same thing. I don't know if I'd have ever gone to rehab, but I would definitely be pounding 40s behind a gas station. Like, I understand.
There's no judgment here.
I understand the virtue of it.
It's, I walk along that road, the Lansdowne Road, it's called, and there's a very endearing sign that's out there, and it says, "No sitting, this is a private area, go drink somewhere else!" Exclamation mark. It's
fascist.
A long cardboard wooden ride, and it's out of that area. They were having, well, they've got all of the St. George's flags up, the England flags, the white, the red cross on it, St. George's cross, and it was giant. It was hanging off the front of this house. The house looked like a racist pirate ship with its flag blowing in the wind, and these two young ladies were coming down. I put their age about 17, 18, dressed badly, bad faces, bad complexions, and a foreign fella man with darker complexion was walking by, and one of these young ladies shouted at him, "Don't look at my girl's ass, you fucking tramp, keep walking." And I made sure I was on the other side of the road, because I've got quite a good antenna for when people are about to shout at other people. But I'm happy where I am, because I live in a really lovely, quiet part of it. It's about 3 seconds away from where all that's going on, but somehow there's that invisible line we've spoken about on the show before, where badness does not pass one way or the other.
Yeah, there's a guy who's heavily addicted to Oxycontin. He'll steal and stuff, and he lives about a block away, but he only steals from other people who are also addicted to Oxycontin, basically. Just, he never comes to the straight houses for some reason.
I guess there's an honor in that.
Yeah, I guess there's just this unspoken divide, and I don't know why he supports the divide, but he does.
It doesn't seem to be in his interest to support that divide.
Why not? Twitter for the week. So, when I say Twitter for the week, I think I actually mean Twitter for the month or some shit. How long were we gone? It was a while.
About 3 weeks.
That's absurd. That's way too long.
That's way too long.
I don't know what the hell to do. Without the show to punctuate being on Twitter, I just hate. It revolts me.
I haven't missed it.
I've been reading this great biography of Robert Mitchum, a film noir actor who...
Oh, I love Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, died in 1997. You already know all about that. But this book, it's by Lee Server. I think it came out in 2004 or something. I got it at the library. And I'll tell you right now that you can't buy it online, so you're going to need to buy it online. But I am a huge fan of this book, and it talks about all... He was a boxcar hobo. That's fantastic. I need to watch all his movies now. He was a straight-up boxcar hobo in the Great Depression. He wandered the land. That guy served on a chain gang. How fantastic is that?
There's two movies of his I absolutely love. And they're separated by about 40 years. The first is Charlie Lawton's Night of the Hunter, which is a wonderful one-off kind of movie. It's dreamlike and twilight, and he plays a preacher with love and hate tattooed across his fist, and he's swindling, and the kids see through him. And there's another movie, which is the remake of a film that he was in before, called Cape Fear, the Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro Cape Fear, which I liked. It's so obnoxiously stupid.
I remember, when did that come out? I remember being very young and hearing about the bad reviews for that. I think my uncle had seen it, and we were at some family get together, and he was just bitching incessantly about this movie. And I'm however young I am, too young to know.
It's a stupid film, but it's really fun with it. And De Niro's doing a really bad southern accent throughout.
Oh no, now I can't watch it. I cannot stand it when people that I love try to do accents, because I love them for who they are. I don't love them as character actors. I don't want to see De Niro play characters. I want to see him play that guy who looks like Robert De Niro.
That Brooklyn guy with a bad temper.
Right. Well, Tommy Lee Jones in The Electric Mist doing that Louisiana accent just infuriates me, because I loved you so much, Tommy Lee Jones, and I can't, even if this accent's dead on, I can't handle it coming out of your face.
Did I tell you about that Tommy Lee Jones film that I sat down and watched, where he had to look after a sorority house for spoiled rich girls?
Who else was in that?
Oh, I don't remember who else was in that.
I vaguely remember this coming. He did that, there's that string after Volcano where he was in a spate of just terrible comedies. I think he was trying to ride on Men in Black, which, by the way, is a wonderful film, I think.
Sure. I mean, if you like, I can add a little interview I did with my brother when he was about 9. And he's talking about how much he loved Men in Black 3.
I grew up with Men in Black. I used to watch it with my grandpa all the time. He loved that movie.
I liked it too. I used to have it on a silver VHS.
I remember we went to, it was my little brother's 9th birthday or something, and I was a very depressed child for some good reasons and some terrible reasons. But we were at a horse thing. We were out by my grandma and grandpa's place. We went to something where you ride horses and then you have cake or whatever. It was a horse-related birthday party.
Right.
And this is going to defeat my whole character, but I didn't want to be anywhere near horses, because I was very ardently a dog person. I didn't understand horses or the people who rode them. It was a complete, it mystified me at this young age, however young I was, 12, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I was just completely having this meltdown of, I don't understand what's going on here. So I walked across the canal and across these dirt roads all the way back to my grandma and grandpa's place and put on Men in Black and just watched it while everyone else was at this party. And I felt like the biggest piece of shit who's ever crawled the earth. It was horrible. I still think back on it with trauma, but I've learned to re-embrace how much I enjoy that movie. There's many good memories associated with it.
I've got I don't have it anymore. It's been thrown out. But speaking of VHSs, I had a VHS of Simpsons, Viva Los Simpsons, and it had four episodes of The Simpsons. It had up to about 88 minutes, and I bunked off school. I was about 10 or 11 years old. And any time I'd do something wrong at that age, I'd feel a pain in the pit of my stomach. So repellent was the idea. It would happen whenever I'd bunked off stool, but I wouldn't go to stool. And so I'd watch the tape of The Simpsons because that would make me happy. I think Homer at the Bat was on there as well. And sometimes, like, when one of those episodes comes on, I am right there as a small boy alone in a council flat in West Norwood. And I've just got the feeling crushing down on me of this guilt of not having done what I was supposed to do.
I got to cut you off. I was doing editing on last week's episode.
Yeah.
Because there were some audio issues. Nobody cares. But you said you don't know who Charles Portis is. Go read Norwood. Go read that. Read that book. Read it and get back to me. He wrote True Grit. How do you not know Charles Portis? That is an important name to be familiar with. Go fix that.
Oh, I know True Grit. I've seen both John Wayne and Big Lebowski versions of the film.
I like the Big Lebowski version a little bit better at the time.
I like Rooster Todburn. That's a sequel to True Grit.
I haven't seen that, actually, so you're in deeper than me, but you got to read his books. His books are great. They're very unvarnished and plain, and they're wildly funny. Norwood, in particular, I think, is a hysterical book.
At the moment, I'm reading Dante's Divine Comedy. It's a long, long poem from the 12th century.
I know what that is.
Let me give you a trick. It's quite well written.
Let me finish this Robert Mitchum anecdote. There was this great line in this book where he said, no matter how famous he got, he always would tell people, I'm only here between trains. And I thought that was the best sentence that anyone has ever uttered. That's saying that no matter what happens here on Earth, you're between trains. You're going to catch a westbound at the end of your life, pal, no matter what happens to you.
That's awesome. I like that a lot.
And there was one other sentence in there. It was there between the lissome thighs of a sympathetic stripper that Robert Mitchum lost whatever technically remained of his innocence. And I thought that was another fantastic. That's not even biographical. It's just a great sentence.
Yeah.
Whatever tech. Lee Server.
Right.
He's an acclaimed biographer, I guess. I don't know who else he biographed. But on the back of the book, it said he's an acclaimed biographer. And my hunch is that I agree because I'm acclaiming this book right now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, go ahead.
Just sticking with the theme of old Hollywood, conceited Audie Murphy made a film detailing all the killing he did during the war. I never saw Sylvester Stallone's film about his admirable Vietnam era experience where he coached the girls' football team in Switzerland to a Mighty Dutch style victory. And that's a film that I watched. And then I started thinking about an imaginary interview with Audie Murphy. I'm glad you asked, chuckled Audie Murphy. I needed you to be aware that men died at my hand. I straight up mowed people down. I mean, he placed his drink on the table, eyes wide. These were foot soldiers with widows and orphans left behind. Now I'll die rich. Do you see? Hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent putting that on the silver screen. God bless America. He became animated, arms gesticulating passionately. Of course, said Audie, with a new, quiet, self-deprecating charm charming himself. I was the one who felt like God on top of that tank.
That's way over 140 characters.
That's a series of tweets.
Wow, it's way long. It's very, very long. Nobody's going to retweet that. It's so long. No, I'm just bullshitting you. There was something that I started writing a while ago that I really liked, and I realized recently that I've moved on and I'm never going to finish it. So I'm just going to run down what it was going to be. Let me see if I can't find it. I have it here somewhere. Or I have a rough draft of what it was supposed to be. Anyway, there's this Marine versus Professor email, you know, conservative email forwards, right?
Sure, yeah. I saw Twitter got a hold of this just before I left. It was Marine Todd. A Marine Todd would go and punch him in the face because God wasn't around to do it.
Right, well, it's a variant of a much older story, which is basically, you know, the professor breaks the chalk in half and puts it on the ground. And if God's real, then pick up the chalk and break it. You know, and it's just this very asinine, feel better about God and country kind of nonsense. Yeah. And so I decided to, but it's a image, it's a picture with the text on the picture, and it's a this big tatted up Marine with, you know, giant muscles on his arms, whatever those arm muscles are called.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's the inept and incomprehensible professor and the proud jingoistic Marine, and I took it upon myself to recreate that meme with the same insufferable artifacted font and the dumb picture of the arm. But, coffee, I need to make coffee happen. How about you, Vamp?
Okie dokie. So, Marines, we were talking about John Wayne earlier, and a film that he made was The Green Beret.
But I made it about an evil Harvard professor in the 1950s, a legitimately evil Harvard professor. Like, how do we reintroduce actual danger into this story?
Some real conflict, John, as good as you've been in.
And I wanted to get the same message across, but with actual danger. So I'm not going to read the old ones because I didn't want to go back that far in my Twitter because I would wind up deleting a bunch of stuff I no longer am proud of and it would ruin everything. But where was I? No, it's about an evil Harvard professor in the 1950s who was enrolled the Marine in a mind control experiment, not unlike that one the Unabomber was involved with. Let's set the scene. The Marine walks in to the lecture hall alone, and the professor says, "Are you ready?" And he's completely emotionless like this, which is the most evil tone of voice a person can possibly achieve because it's cold and inhuman. And the professor says to the Marine, "Are you ready?" And it's very cold in the lecture hall, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Marine says to himself, I'm walking into death, aren't I? And the professor says, "It will all be over very soon. It will be me and you, and I will test you. And then there will be a confrontation. Understand that you are a liar, so there must be a confrontation." And you can hear slightly the emotional tenor of the professor getting a bit twitchier. And they go into the sequestered area with a glass partition, you know, an examination, an interrogation room. And the examiner walks in. There's an examiner. He's a very tall man with a black trench coat, and he strides in far too slowly with his briefcase. And the Marine is placed behind the partition, and the examiner starts belittling his worldview as the professor stands behind, past the partition with a microphone. You still with me here? You with me? You enjoying this version of the Marine versus Professor conservative jingoistic email forward? You liking it?
Hey, so much so far.
And so the examiner is belittling what the Marine believes in a very real way. They had him fill out a survey earlier, I explained, and he listed what he believed in a way that he thought was going to be non-judgmental, and now they're judging all of it. Mm. And the examiner says, "Pitiful to believe in a creator God. Show me your Christ. Where's Christ when I strike you?" And then he strikes the Marine. And the Marine is been placed in this position of power, of institutional powerlessness, where it's not socially correct to strike the examiner. And the examiner continues to go on destroying the Marine in this way, breaking down his energies one after the other. And the examiner keeps gesturing toward a briefcase, and the Marine says, you know, he musters all of his effort to say, "What's the briefcase for?" And the examiner says, You'll see very soon." And the Marine starts sweating. It's because it's way too hot now. They've been messing with the heat in the room to destabilize the Marine.
To break them down.
Mm-hmm. And the Marine stops sweating, and the examiner says, "Disgusting! Stop sweating! Stop sweating!"
I'm imagining he played by Kevin Spacey.
Probably, yeah. Or Guy Pearce, maybe, in a really bad mood. But basically what the examiner is doing now is he's denying basic physiology to break him down as much as you can. He's saying that sweating is disgusting, and everyone sweats.
Sure.
And so he gets out the briefcase and he removes a hammer from the briefcase and he strikes the Marine's finger with it and blood sprays. And he goes, "Show me any proof that there is order to the universe. Show me, Marine. Show me, liar." And then the examiner ushers the professor back into the room. And he says, "The confrontation is going very well, Professor, don't you think?" And then he takes out a .44 from his belt and he murders the professor. Just one shot, the professor is dead. And he says, "Don't worry, Murray. In reality is not objective. There is no professor, for all you know. It says in your file you think reality is objective. That's foolish. That's disgusting. Stop sweating! Let me show you how reality is subjective, Marine." And then he shoots the Marine repeatedly in the leg. And he stares at the Marine and he gets as close as he can. And he sprinkles spittle on the Marine. And he goes, "You see? Reality is subjective. You believe you feel pain, but I have no reason to believe that you even exist. I feel no pain at all." And the Marine bleeds and he's crying. And the examiner says, "What do you think of bullets now?" I forgot what the ending to that was going to be.
Right.
I think it's funny. I think it's good comedy.
It's disappointing that you didn't have a climax there. You kind of...
But, you know, not enough people retweeted it. I guess not enough people understood why it was so funny.
Not very funny to them, they thought.
I know. Well, people are plebes. They don't understand great comedy. Disgusting. Stop sweating. Anyway, so I guess I'll go ahead and close on an actual joke instead of a long and rambling
shaggy
nightmare.
Dog story.
Yeah, that wasn't even a shaggy dog story. That was just a nightmare.
Yeah.
That's why we call it the Last Exit Show.
Yep.
That's exactly why we named it, because of that story I just said 68 episodes in. But I thought it would be really funny to tour coffee houses and open mics as a 1970s kind of Laurel Canyon-esque singer-songwriter. With, it's all my own original material. I'm inspired by Bob Dylan, though, but I have no songs. I'm just doing the singer-songwriter shtick, and I hold a guitar, but I never play it, ever.
Slowly tuning it into Phoenix, just sitting there in your hands as you kind of ramble around like Arlo Guthrie.
Right, but I do all the banter. Steve, I know you hate that word. That's what they call it on bootleg sites. In between the songs, they call it banter, so that's why, yeah. I said that. It was a knee jerk. But I would do all the song introductions, is what you could say, instead of banter. Mm-hmm. And so I would go, "When I was 13, I left my home and I hitchhiked, and my uncle was very supportive. And I'd write to my uncle, and he'd write to me. He'd always say, 'Take pictures, send me a picture,' because he was real sick. And he had cancer. And one night I came home and the money had run out and my guts had run out, I guess, too. And my uncle had died and I'd never gotten around to sending him a picture. And this song is for him. It's called Dreams by Rivers. Thank you. This next song, I don't know if you watch news, but one night I sat down on TV to watch the news. And my dad always watched the news. I figured I'd be more grown up, you know, if I watched it like my dad watched it. And I clicked through every channel and there's no news. It was people commenting on the news. It was like the ghosts of the news, and I was supposed to pick up on it. Anyway, the song is called Emily's Alone Now. It goes like this. And then nothing. I just stare at people. Just for as long as... Just into... Leave. I dare you to leave.
Break the sacred silence that builds up around a man with an acoustic guitar. Dramatic tension there.
Anyway, I guess we can go ahead. All right, let's close on an obnoxious joke. Big Jim Murphy, have you heard that new Black Keys summer jam?
No.
I'll tell you, the new Black Keys summer jam is the best summer jam since Lynyrd Skynyrd broke up, you know, in that airplane. Good night, everybody.
We're really pleased to be back. This is the Last Exit Show. If you want to follow Caleb on the Twitter, you should do that. His name's at Caleb Hortman, K-A-L-E-B-H-O-R-T-O-N. You can find me at _ James Murphy. I was concerned that we wouldn't really know how to podcast, but that's a tautology. That's a contradiction in terms. Anyone can podcast, but you shouldn't. You should find the show's Twitter. It's at Last Exit Show, spelt as it's pronounced. And if you want to support the tours that gave us, our old religion and laws, you should, and if you can, if you feel comfortable doing so, why not throw a couple of dollars into the hat? I'm holding the bottle, and the bottle's got a fly in it, so I can hold the money in one hand, and Caleb will know that I, as the bottle guy, won't take any of the money as he plays his old blues harmonica at the end of the pier. So if you want to put a dollar into the hat and do all of that, then you should go to thelastexitshow@gmail.com on PayPal. Thank you very much. We can't wait to see you next week.
Hangman, hangman, slack your rope, slack it for a while. Think I see my father coming riding a many a mile. Papa, did you bring me silver? Papa, did you bring me gold? Did you come to see me hanging by the gallows pole? Well, I couldn't bring no silver, didn't bring no gold. I've come to see you hang by the gallows pole. Hangman, hangman, slack your rope, slack it for a while. Think I see my mother coming riding a many a mile. Riding a many a mile. Well, mama, did you bring me silver? Mama, did you bring me gold? Did you come to see me hang by the gallows pole? I didn't bring no silver, didn't bring no gold. I've come to see you hanging by the gallows pole, by the gallows pole, oh God. Hangman, hangman, slack your rope, slack it for a while. Think I see my sweetheart coming riding a many a mile, riding a many a mile, oh God. Riding a many a mile. Honey, did you bring me silver? Honey, did you bring me gold? Did you come to see me hang by the gallows pole? Hanging by the gallows pole. Brought you silver, brought you little gold.